The Book Nook on WYSO was presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Back in 2002, I did my only interview with a poet named Benjamin Zephaniah. It was April of 2002, National Poetry Month that year, and he had a novel out, but he also talked to us about his poetry. His novel was called Refugee Boy, and he was in town to do an event at Books and Company. It was an afternoon event because they had a lot of teachers coming in. And he was an amazing guy. He didn't learn to read or write until he was 21 years old. And I didn't realize when I interviewed him 22 years ago that he was very famous in Great Britain. I had no idea how famous he was. I still didn't know 22 years later. And then in December, I saw his obituary in the New York Times. And I realized, yeah, this guy was famous. He wrote 30 books over his career. He wrote a lot about racism and environmental issues. He's considered the first poet to address the climate crisis in his poetry. He also was in a TV series called Peaky Blinders. He played a character named Jeremiah Jesus. And the year after I interviewed him, I didn't know this until I read his obituary in the New York Times. In 2003, Tony Blair was the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And of course, Queen Elizabeth was still alive. And he was awarded the most prestigious honor of the British Empire in 2003. And he said, forget it, you can shove that order of the British Empire. He was quoted as saying, stick it, Mr. Blair and Mrs. Queen. Stop going on about the empire. I get angry when I hear the word empire. It reminds me of slavery. It reminds me of thousands of years of brutality. Let's listen now to the late Benjamin Zephaniah. We call it the Best of the Book Nook.
Today my guest is Benjamin Zephaniah. His book is Refugee Boy, and he's traveled a long way to get here. He came all the way from England. Welcome to the program.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Benjamin, tell us about yourself.
It's a long story.
That's fine. We've got plenty of time.
Essentially, I started life as a performance poet. I loved words and the way that you could say words, and they would have an effect upon people, depending on the way you said it. And I started performing my poetry in a city called Birmingham, in England, where I live. And I made quite a name for myself at an early age because I couldn't even spell the word politics, but I was very concerned with certain issues of race and gender. When I was a little kid, it was the Biafran War and the famine in Biafra, which was a big thing. And so I would stand on street corners and be doing my poetry in community centres, even in church. And I came from a home with a very violent father. So then my mother kind of spent a lot of time running away from my father. He just kept hunting her down, and we kept having to move on. I've never met a child that's been to as many schools as me. But I left school at the age of 13. And then I suppose I just kind of lived on the wrong side of the law. I got in trouble with the police. I went to prison, stuff like this. I didn't write a lot while I was in prison. In fact, I couldn't read and write at that time. So I was, even though I was doing poetry, it was creating the poetry in my head and performing it. Putting it on the page wasn't really that important. And then there's a time when I came out of prison. I said, I'm not going back in there. But I said, actually, if I go back in there, it will be for political reasons rather than, you know, stealing some candy. And I started doing my performance poetry quite seriously, I suppose. And then I began to earn a living from it, which I think was really strange. I couldn't believe it at the time. And my poetry was very political and quite critical of the government. And I remember when a taxman knocked on my door and said, you've got to start paying tax. I said, no, I can't pay tax to the government. I'm anti the government. And they said, it doesn't matter, you've got to pay tax. And I also, you know, I had a book of poetry, which was quite a well-known book at the time in Britain. It's called Penrhyn. And even when that was a bestseller, I realized that a lot of the people I wanted to reach still didn't read books. So I really concentrated on performing. So I made a name for myself with doing two things, really. One was demystifying poetry, making it accessible, talking about things that everyday people could identify with. And I started to, I mean, one of my earliest performances doing poetry was with Bob Marley, the person you just played, literally standing at the side of the stage saying, do you mind if I go on and do a few poems? Go on, and that was it. So I knew a lot of people in that audience weren't reading books. So I performed for them. I put poetry on television, poetry on record, poetry in theatre. Anywhere where people saw and listened kind of thing, because that's how I picked up my knowledge rather than reading. And then much later on, I come round again to writing, putting poetry in books. But I still think there are, you know, that's a particular art form. There are poems that I do for performance that are not in books, and I don't think they work well on the page. There are some poems which work well on the page, which I would never perform. I don't think they work well in performance. Some do both. Some do both quite well. And then, well, that's it really. And then years on, a publisher came to me and said, would you publish a book, a novel? And I said, no. And they said, please. And I said, no. And they persuaded me. And in fact, Refugee Boy, the one which I'm now touring the States promoting, is actually my second novel, although it's the first one to be officially released in the States. The first one was called Face, which will be released in the States soon. But for some reason, Refugee Boy was chosen first. So that's it, really. And my novels, essentially, they're for teenagers. But, you know, adults read them. I heard it on the grapevine that you read one. so there you go. And you know, I deal with issues. I kind of write, I think, because I was a reluctant reader and I couldn't read and write, I didn't learn to read and write until I was 21 properly. I thought, what would be the thing that would have interested me? Which is right. My first novel, Face, was about a boy who, he's not a bad boy, but he gets into a stolen car and a stolen car crashes. And then he has his face completely burnt. And it's about how he goes back to school. And although he's a white boy, he doesn't really look, he's not got anything against black kids, but he doesn't really sit next to them. But when he goes back to school, a lot of his white friends don't want to sit next to him. They think he's ugly now. And he starts making friends with black kids, and he gets into hip-hop, and his life changes. And then Refugee Boy, which is a really big issue in Britain now, especially in schools, young kids are coming as refugees. They can't speak English, then they get there, and it's about what they have to go through, really, that fascinates me. I think I'm interested in when teenagers suddenly have to change, and something's affected their life so much that all of a sudden they've got to come to terms with some profound changes.
This book is political.
Yes.
What kind of political things were you speaking out about in your poetry?
Well, I find that everything I do seems to be political, but at the same time, not part political. I can never tell anywhere to anybody at the end of the day who to go and vote for. I think my bottom line to people is get involved. Don't sit down and think that you are participating in democracy because you vote every 4 years or 5 years. My other point is that I think politicians get away with a lot because we do sit down and do nothing for 4 years. And sometimes, you know, they have, just coming up to the election campaign, they have this campaign, they go around, they kiss your babies, and then for the next 5 years, they form a dictatorship, and then they'd be very nice again. And but the thing that I feel passionately about is, one is I'll say the term now and then I'll just double back on it, domestic violence. I don't like the term domestic violence anyway, because I think murder is murder, and being beaten up is being beaten up, and being raped is being raped. I think if it happens in the home, I mean, what happens in Britain is that a police officer will give it less importance because it's domestic. This word domestic seems to mean that it's kind of in the home, it's a bit cosy, and they'll sort it out. And, you know, a lot of women die in, and men have died in so-called domestic situations. So that's one issue. And as I said, my father spent a lot of time beating my mother, so I saw it firsthand. Racism is very close to me, obviously, because it's something that I've suffered, being black and having Caribbean parents, being a first-generation black to be born in Britain and grow up there. Disabilities is also something that I feel very passionately about. But again, I also think that we kind of misuse the word disability. And I think I look at this, some people who are so-called disabled. I have disabled friends who paint beautiful paintings with their toes. I can't do that. They're just differently abled. Mm-hmm. And I think the disabilities for a lot of people who just don't know how to deal with these people. And there's a part in my book where in my first book, Face, where the boy is talking to a community worker who's trying to get him to come to the youth club. And he says, well, Martin, we welcome people here regardless of their gender, regardless of their race, religion, and regardless of their disabilities. He's obviously saying this to my character because he got a burnt face. My character hits off at him and says, look, I'm not disabled. You know, there's a lot of things that you can do that I can't do, things that I can't do that you can do. If you cannot deal with me just because I look like this, you are intellectually disabled. And so I sometimes think the word disabled is used wrongly, incorrectly sometimes. I think our countries, when I say our countries, I mean your country, the United States of America and Britain, spend a lot of time bombing third world countries when we could be doing a lot more things with that money, for in terms of healthcare, etc. I think terrorism is a very bad thing, but I also think, you know, I don't care where it comes from, if it comes from you, me, Hamas, or a government. I think because the government does this, I don't think all of a sudden it is not terrorism. And I think that a war on terrorism, which is my thing at the moment, is just, it's like, you know, it's a war on what? I mean, where do you go and find this thing called terrorism? If we, the British, wanted to have the approach which the Americans are having now in Afghanistan, for example, we would have been bombing Boston.
Boston, Massachusetts?
Yeah, because, you know, there's an organization in Britain which supports the IRA and gives money to the IRA in America, I beg your pardon.
Sure.
But we don't. We try and deal with it. And in fact, Britain has learned to deal with it politically. We got Sinn Féin, we started talking to them. And in fact, Sinn Féin are beginning to disarm quicker than the British government can deal with it now. They really want to get involved in the democratic process. There are a lot of things. I think, you know, the idea of globalization is one which I'm very suspicious of. I mean, I think I am a great example of globalization. I spend my time going around the world having what I call cultural intercourse with people. You know, we are talking about writing, what is going on in Britain, what's happening in playwriting in America, and I've just come from a country where very few Americans ever go, Libya. But I can talk to Americans about literature in Libya now, and, you know, so I think I've been doing that for a long time. But the idea of, you know, a country sitting back in the United States or in Canada or in America and just exploiting somebody in another country, calling it globalization, they don't spend the money in that country, they bring the money back here or back to their Britain or Canada. And I don't think that's globalization at all, I think that's exploitation.
So you're saying globalization is just a fancy word for exploitation?
In many instances, yes. Yeah. I mean, I think there are some interesting. There are some companies which are. I know of a banking organization in Britain which is now working in Bangladesh with women who never saved before, and they've allowed them to form their own bank, and the bank in Britain just gives them advice and just help them set up. And those women are able to put their money into this bank, get a good rate of interest. They're able to then take control of their lives, build their houses, send their children to school. And those children, this is very important, in the past and still today, some of them are making, I won't mention any name, but they're making trainers, do you call them trainers? You know, footwear for sports.
For Nike? Just kidding.
Who you mentioned?
Swoosh.
There you go.
Yeah. Getting paid, what, 10 cents a day, maybe?
I mean, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But you know what I'm saying. So, but there are some companies that have learned that they've got to approach these things differently. But I think there are some other companies which just do not care. It's about bringing the profits home.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, revisiting an interview I did 22 years ago with a poet named Benjamin Zephaniah. He died in December. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling on the air and online. We'll continue with Benjamin right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, my 2002 interview with the late Benjamin Zephaniah.
What were you doing in Libya?
I was doing a tour of poetry, just like the tour I'm doing here.
Really?
Yes. I mean, I wasn't actually promoting a book as such, but I was just performing poetry.
I hear it's beautiful there.
Libya is one of the most beautifulest countries I've come across. It's quite amazing. And I have never been into old ruins, but when I was there, I really got into them. And you go to Syrie, which is like, they say... it was Simon of Cyrene that carried the cross for Jesus Christ. And you go to the place where he came from. And a lot of Roman ruins are just places in the ground. You can see these rocks in the ground. But the buildings are standing there. You can walk into the bathroom. And it's quite amazing. It really is beautiful. And the Libyan government does not allow any kind of tourists in the country. You have to come with an interest, a genuine interest in the country. I mean, I don't know what it's like for American citizens there, but you know, you have to work hard to get your visa. You have to say where you want to come, and you have to, you know, say your interest. And if you just, you know, if you say you want to come and lie on the beach, no way.
You've got to find a better reason and then go lie on the beach.
Well, you know, they just don't have that beach culture. There are beaches and you can go and spend time with the sea, but it's not. And yes, it is absolutely beautiful. And they have a love of literature. And let me tell you something else very quickly. They have a love of things American and British.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite amazing, especially Shakespeare and Oscar Wilde. And and the people on the streets all seem to be well read. And to be honest, they kept asking the same questions about American and British foreign policy. You know, and at the same time, they love things American. It was really fascinating.
And good Italian food, no doubt.
Yeah, a lot of Italian food. you know this.
Well, I know that the Italians used to think they owned Libya.
That's right.
Just like they invaded Ethiopia. That's why there's Italian food in those parts of the world.
That's right, yes. And I also make mention of that in my in my book.
Let's talk about the book Refugee Boy. Give us an idea of the plot, Benjamin.
What I didn't want to do, I didn't want to take sides in the war. So it starts from the war in Ethiopia and Eritrea. But as I said, I didn't want to take sides. So Alam, the main character, is his mother is Eritrean and his father is Ethiopian. They are Pan-Africanists in a sense. They believe in a United States of Africa. But their two countries are going to war with each other. And Alam is half and half, and they're not at peace in any country. In both sides of the border, one is being called a traitor. So his father decides to send him to Britain to get a better life, and they were worried about his safety. And he comes to Britain. His father goes home and leaves him, knowing that a refugee council and some other organisations will pick him up and find him a place to live and a school to go. And it's really about how he comes to terms with being in a new place and how the place comes to terms with him in a way, because we're not quite welcoming of refugees at the moment. The politicians are using it as a bit of a political football. And especially at the moment, it's quite ironic because the Labour Party, who were so against the policies that the Tory parties were having when they were in opposition, are now doing the same policies once they're in power. And in Britain at the moment, we use words like bogus refugees, false refugees.
Bogus, know? Like yeah. They don't have a reason to be a refugee?
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so Alan, who's obviously a genuine refugee, has to deal with, he reads about these things in the papers and they affect him because he feels that Britain is a country that helps people. That's what he's been told, you know, compassionate, loving people. And a nation, a country which was uninhabited, a nation which is being built by people who are all refugees of one kind or another. If you go right back to the Angles and the Saxons, they came there running from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not quite sure how much you want me to give away, but he has a bad experience. Well, he loses his mother, and the news about his father is not so good either. And he ends up having to stay in Britain. And a lot of it is set in court as well, about his battle legally to stay in Britain. And there's two things I was adamant about when I was creating this book. I didn't want to do a story that was too out of this world. I mean, you made a comment when I walked in the studio about his father. But I talked to a lot of refugees, and I wanted to do a story that was realistic, that was possible, what was happening to kids. And I wanted to make sure that all the court proceedings and everything else was correct. And I had to go, just before it was going to press, for example, I had to go back and write something in, which is only touched upon. After the Refugee Council read the book in manuscript form, they said, "You've missed something out. When these children come, they are taken away, and they are fingerprinted and photographed and really interrogated by the police." And I didn't have this. So I went back and I touched on it. But it's not in there as bad as it really is, because apparently children hate this. I mean, it's very demoralising,
uh-huh.
And they are treated like criminals at that point. So that's basically the mm-hmm. story, without giving too much away, because there are lots of twists and turns in the
sure.
book. But the important thing is, like I say, that it can happen. It's quite realistic.
My guest is Benjamin Zephaniah. His book is Refugee Boy.
I've been doing a lot of talks for students, even college students, very small children on this tour. But now I address teachers, which is a bit bizarre. I don't know what I'm going to say to them. I mean, I'll probably, you know, I'll ask them if they can help me with my maths. I'll just be talking about my book. You see, one of the things that teachers are saying to me all the time, actually, is that I am turning a lot of young people onto writing, and I'm also severely dyslexic, and I'm a late starter. I didn't have, you know, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. And so it's, how can we engage children, you know, how can we get them interested in the world? How can we get them interested in politics and literature? And how can we also tell them that if they've made a mistake, it's not the end of the world, you know, you can pick yourself up and dust yourself off and start over again. And I suppose I'm an example of someone who's managed to do that. I mean, I don't like... I've just told my publisher of my poetry, they tend to, on my poetry books, they always tend to put on the back that I've been in prison. And sometimes, you know, they talk about that quite a lot. And this was in 1974, 1975 or something. And I say, well, that's not really... I mean, it's such a long time ago. I've done so many things. Why do you have to put that on the jacket? And they've stopped doing it now, but they do say that people want to know this because it shows other kids that have had a brush with the law that, you know, you can still carry on. Because what happens sometimes is, even in the police station, I mean, I had it said to me, for the rest of your life, you're going to be a no good now.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're never going to be able to get a job. You've got a police record. That's it. And, you know, it's not true. And I think another problem is, in the from where I come from, I mean, the place where I come from, and I mean, I don't just mind the physical place, but the cultural place, is that the writers were, when I was young, certainly, they were, the poetry that we were supposed to read was all poetry by white, dead males.
Mm-hmm.
And even the poets and novelists that were alive seemed to all have great, wonderful educations and come from families where they all read books and mummy and daddy sat down and read books to them. Well, I'm addressing a generation that listens to rap music and a generation that their poetry happens on the street. Their poetry happens from word, from mouth to ear. And I want to engage those people. And so that's, teachers talk to me a lot about that, you know, because a lot of the teachers, they are not like that, you know. They spent their time, they were well educated, spent their time in college and universities, and not putting them down, but they've lived a completely different life.
They want to learn how to relate.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And it's difficult. I mean, sometimes teachers get my poems and the children will hear that this is we're doing poetry, they go, oh no. And especially if it's not in Britain, if it's a country they don't know of me, and they say, well, we've got this poet called Benjamin Zephaniah, and I'm going to read some of his poems, and they don't know how to read it.
Uh-huh.
And in Britain, I've actually had a time when a teacher came to me and said that she was reading one of my poems in class, and the class just started laughing. And then one of the kids got up and just read one of my poems for her.
Read it the right way.
Uh-huh. I mean, I think there's no wrong way or right way, but he read it in a way which had much more rhythm
uh-huh.
than what she was trying to do. And there's a quite heavy reggae beat in my work, and it jumps into a Jamaican accent. So this white middle-class lady just wasn't hacking it.
That teacher just wasn't able to recite his poetry the right way. And so I'm thinking, at that point, what a great time to ask him to recite one of his poems. And we're going to have Benjamin do that, at least we did 22 years ago, right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, going back 22 years to an interview I did with the poet Benjamin Zephaniah. And there is a method to the madness of interviewing authors. You got to kind of stretch things out if you're going to be talking to somebody for an hour. And I had spoken to Benjamin for almost a half hour already, and he had not recited any poetry. So we saved that. In fact, this is my favorite part of the interview, because during this part of the interview, he also talks about our vision of Jesus Christ. And this is a guy who played a character named Jeremiah Jesus in a TV series. And we talked about Jesus that day, and how, depending upon who you are, you have your own visual of what Jesus would look like. Is he white? Is he black? How does Jesus look? Is he a black Palestinian with dreadlocks? Who knows? Let's listen now to Benjamin Zephaniah on the Best of the Book Nook.
This seems like a wonderful time to hear a poem.
Okay, well, I'll do something which is only just been published, so it's more of a piece which is written for performance, but I think it's a poem that I use to kind of introduce people to my poetry, and it's got that rhythm behind it, etc. It's called This Poetry. This poetry is like a rhythm that drops. The tongue brings a rhythm that shoots like a shot. This poetry is designed for ranting, dancehall style, big mouth chanting. This poetry won't put you to sleep saying, follow me like your blind sheep. This poetry is not party political, not designed for those who are critical. This poetry goes with me when I go to my bed. It gets into my dreadlocks and it lingers around my head. This poetry is with me when I am riding my bike. I have tried Shakespeare, respect Judea. But this is the stuff I like. This poetry is not afraid of going in a book, no, but this poetry needs ears to hear and eyes to have a look. Yes, this poetry is verbal rhythm, no big words involved. And if I have a problem, the rhythm gets it solved. I have tried to be romantic, it did no good for me. I take a reggae rhythm and build my poetry. I could try something personal, but you've heard it all before. No written words are needed because plenty words in store. This poetry is called dub ranting. The tongue plays a beat and the body starts ganking. This poetry is quick and childish. This poetry is for the wise and foolish. Anybody can do it for free. This poetry is for you and me. Don't stretch your imagination. This poetry is for the good of the nation. Chant in the morning. I chant in the night. I chant in the darkness and under the spotlight. I passed through university. I passed through sociology. And then I got a dread degree in dreadful ghetto-ology. This poetry is with me when I take a walk. And when I am talking to myself in poetry, I talk. This poetry is with me, below me and above, you see? This poetry is from inside me and goes to you with love.
Benjamin Zephaniah with some poetry as we celebrate poetry in the Book Nook. We have been all month and we do it all year here on
great,
the program.
Great. That's what I like to hear.
You have a peripheral character in the book. He's just in the book a little bit and this fellow is a Rastafarian.
Yes.
And I was glad to see that. I was glad to get a flash of that because I think that's very real and very British. You are of Jamaican origin.
Yeah.
Your parents were from Jamaica. Mm. How has Rastafarianism impacted your life?
Well, I actually grew up in a household which is quite unusual. It was partly Christian, partly Muslim, and partly Rastafarian. But the Rastafarianism captured my imagination because it was the one thing that allowed me to be political and spiritual at the same time. I think there are some fundamentalists, if you like, Rastafarians, who you know, I'm always debating with and disagreeing with. Because I do think that if you look at an old book like the Bible and you want to try and live like they lived in the Bible, then you're going to be saying that, you know, we are the chosen few and you're going to be having some rather, what I would think, consider kind of backward attitude towards women's role in the world and things like this. But on the whole, I think the good thing was that it allowed me to be religious and, I'll say spiritual rather than religious, and political at the same time. They say that in Jamaica, they say that 90% of people, 90% of people who are not Rastafarians are Rasta-minded. In the book, it's interesting because here's this character from Ethiopia who meets this Rastafarian from Jamaica, whose great wish is to go back to Africa, and who loves Africa. And it's quite important because I think that we have to recognize that Africa is the place where we all come from, regardless of where we are. It doesn't mean we have to go back there. It doesn't mean that we got to live like we live, like they lived there. Most people in Africa want to live like Americans or British people, so that's not the point, really. It's just a kind of respect for the place, because, and people may say, well, why is that important? And it's important because we have been taught, I was certainly taught, that things that come out of Africa are primitive and negative and backward and not worth anything. I was told that democracy started in Europe, and certain ideas of civilization started in Europe. In Zimbabwe they had a system of voting and democracy thousands of years ago in what they call them Great Zimbabwe, Ancient Zimbabwe. In Egypt, they had a sewer system, a system of social security. I mean, so I think once people start to know that, once young black people start to know that, that we are not just what you see in the media in Britain or in America, you know, we see us on the news doing crime, or you see us doing sport, that we were intellectual, that we did have systems of government that did work. It tells a child that, hey, we can do these things. We've done them in the past and we can do them in the future. And I think it's important for that thing. And Rastafarianism gives, it instilled that pride in people. Marcus Garvey was the prophet, what we call the prophet of Rastafarianism. And he wasn't a socialist or a communist or a capitalist or anything. He said, we do what works for Africa. And his main thing was pride in oneself. And he, although he preached it for black people in much of his writings, he also preached it for white people. But he said that pride didn't mean you were better than the other person. We have a slogan in the race, what I call the race industry back in Britain. All different, but all equal. Because we're different, it doesn't mean one is more superior than the other. So, you know, Rastafarianism taught me that, really. I mean, one can learn that from many things, but for us it was Rastafarianism that taught us that. And my parents, you know, they say that if you ask a Chinese person what God looks like, they describe someone that looks Chinese. If you say that to an Indian person, I mean from India, they describe someone that looks Indian. If you say that to someone from Mexico, they say someone that looks Mexican. If you say that to a white person, an Anglo-Saxon person, they describe someone that looks Anglo-Saxon. If you say that to a black person, they describe someone that looks Anglo-Saxon. Uh-huh. You know, and
that's not consistent, is it?
No, I mean, it shows you what slavery and colonization has done to us. It's different with the Coptic churches of Ethiopia because they have been untouched by Rome, and so when they draw Jesus, they draw Jesus with either an afro or dreadlocks. Uh-huh. But Africans outside Africa. My mother always thought, and she was horrified when I suggested that Jesus was dark-skinned. And I say to people now who tend to think that all Arabs are terrorists and Muslims are bad people and Palestinians, that Christ was a black Palestinian. His family came out of Egypt in slavery and they came and settled in Palestine. He was a black Palestinian. And I put it to most people in the world right now that if Christ walked into many churches, he would be kicked out. People would turn around and, why is this guy with dreadlocks, with sandals, doing in our church?
Black and Palestinian. Bad news. And they call it good news, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's the truth, though. I mean, one of the things I'm really fascinated with, and I studied on, how can I put it, not in a formal way, but just in a kind of night school way, is theology. And it's amazing when you look at the truth behind a lot of religions and behind even the Christ, the person, and things like this. A lot of people just will not face the truth, and they take from the Bible or the Quran or whatever it is, things that suit them. And, I mean, we think, for example, I'm not just being critical of Christianity here. If you look at Islam, there's so many rules that work in favor of women. But they tend to ignore those and use the ones that work against them. Mm. You know, more gospels are written by women, to Christianity now, they're written by men. But the ones that were written by the men were published. Mm-hmm. Jesus touched prostitutes' feet and things like this. He was quite a feminist in a way. Mm-hmm. And people who were seen to be called unclean. And a lot of those people wrote about him. You know, we don't get that. So all those things fascinate me because a lot of those writings are in existence now. We have a university in Birmingham, in England, called Manchester University, where they have a lot of things that are taken out of the Bible before King James made his version. And so I say to people when I talk about this that this is not my theory. You can go and read about this stuff. I mean, that stuff fascinates me.
My guest is Benjamin Zephaniah. His book is Refugee Boy, and he joins us all the way from London, England, and he has a website. It's benjaminzephaniah.com now. What's the deal there? What's on your website? Is it poetry or?
There's a little bit of poetry, and there's poems that people send me from all over the world. I think that's a fascinating part of it. There's a kids section, and it's my kids' poetry and the novels that I've written for children. And then there's a section for adults and teenagers. Not yet, but there's going to be a bit of music. I've also recorded about 7 albums to date.
Oh, really?
Music as well, yeah. So there's a music section. And then there's a bit where it's just articles that I've written. Lots of reviews. I tend to like the reviews that little children do. I've got reviews from 5-year-old kids or, you know, stuff like that. And what else is it? That's that kind of thing, really. Uh-huh. I don't sell from there. I just cannot be bothered. People tell me all the time I should sell, and I can organise this credit card thing where people give you the credit card number and you can send them books and things like this. I leave that to, you know, the bookshops and people like that. I just want somewhere for people to go. And it's very useful for when I'm touring a country that they don't know about me, and they can go to the website and see beforehand and do a bit of homework.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is, really.
Well, I'm glad you don't sell on your website, and I appreciate where you're coming from.
Yeah. I just think it's a space for people to see me, and it's not. I write to communicate with people, and I've just got myself a literary agent, you know, for the first time in all these years, because I wanted to take the negotiating thing, the money thing away from it and just concentrate on the art. But the most important thing for me is not, quite frankly, publishing on television, publishing on the internet, or publishing in a book for that matter. I'll do anything that allows me to publish in your heart.
Uh-huh.
And that's it.
Well, we all need a safe place, particularly in this country with its incredible consumerism. We all need a safe place where people aren't saying how much something costs. People aren't talking about money. We all need to find a place in our hearts where consumerism and commercialism and selling and globalization and all that stuff, it's just not there.
I think, you know, it's happening all over the world, but it strikes me a lot in America when I come here that so many people, and it's not an anti-American thing, because like I say, it's happening in Britain, happening all over the world. So many people know the price of things, but the value of nothing.
Hmm. Well, thank you for coming out to see us.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for tolerating me. You did well.
That was the late Benjamin Zephaniah, who died in December. He came to the Book Nook 22 years ago to talk about his novel Refugee Boy and a lot of other things. And he was an amazing guy. And I was really glad to be able to dust that interview off and share it with you. As we're heading into April and National Poetry Month, getting started a little early with a little poetry there from one of the best-known poets in the United Kingdom. And tomorrow, on Easter Sunday, I'm going to be interviewing Eric Rickstad in the Book Nook. He's got a novel out called Lilith. And the topic in this novel is gun control, or lack of it. And I want to bring you a little excerpt from his novel. A voice, but no one is here. It comes from a tiny TV perched in a high corner of the room. I didn't know the TV was here. Someone must have turned it on, or perhaps it has been on all along. I don't remember. I don't care. A pale flicker plays on the walls in my shadowed nighttime hour. A man on the TV is talking to a blonde woman. The man is broad and bulked. He sports a double-breasted navy blazer that fits square on his frame. His mane of hair, mantled above his immense forehead, is the same deep shoe-polished black as his handlebar mustache. His unbuttoned blazer reveals a silver dress shirt that shimmers like shark skin, and a tie as red as blood embroidered in white thread with the words, "The Second Amendment is my gun permit." I gnaw the inside of my cheek, taste blood. The ticker below the man, "Maximilian Akers, founder of More Guns, Less Crime." The anchor says, "Maximilian Akers, You're a regular we speak with here, as our loyal viewers know, after terrible events like yesterday's at the Bristol High School in Indiana. Indiana. Another one. Already. These events are such a tragedy, Suze, this Acres says. Events. Tragedy. We invite you because you are the leading expert on the Second Amendment, Suze says, and you believe that the Second Amendment is under siege, and events like yesterday's and last month's at Franklin Elementary in Franklin, Michigan, are being weaponized to take away your rights. You believe more guns is the answer to stop these sad events. More guns? Acres winks at Suze. Suze, I believe that with every drop of my red, white, and blue blood, that's why more guns, less crime pushes for all students and teachers to legally carry firearms on campuses and in schools nationwide, as is their God-given right. God. Think, Suze. If teachers and students, good, God-loving citizens, are armed and trained and more guns, less crime trains folks, you can sign up for a reasonable fee to get training at any of our 5 franchise schools across this great land. Do you think someone is going to try to shoot up a class if they know classmates and teachers and even the damn janitor are armed and trained to kill? Suze nods for him to continue. That's why, Suze, that's why for 10 years of owning my gun shop here in Jessup, the leading gun shop in all these great United States, I haven't had a security system. I don't need one. I got iron bars in the windows for nighttime security. And from the second I step foot out of the house in the morning, I have a Beretta M9 strapped to my hip to defend myself in any and all situations against the evils of this world. I don't need anything else. Opponents call you the profiteer of paranoia, Suze says. Say you play off people's fears to make an obscene profit of blood money. They say the Rolex you wear is an example of a fortune amassed by body count. With a practiced vigor, Acres snaps his arm out, his French cuff riding up to reveal a fat gold Rolex that hulks on his hairy wrist. My followers embrace my success as a legal gun dealer. They'd love to be in my shoes. Who doesn't want a Rolex? None of my gun sales have ever been proved to be linked to a shooting or to illegal provenance. Proved to be. They point to your vast amount of holdings in arms manufacturing, Suze says. Not illegal. It's my God-given right to make money. Frankly, I am sick and tired of being slandered and victimized. We all are, Acres says. I speak for millions of good people, and I profit off reality. And the reality is that the fear my followers have of their guns and rights being stripped away is real because the threat is real, and these events, they're used against those who love their country and, yes, their guns the most. What is wrong with loving what keeps you safe and free from tyranny? Some even say these events at schools are staged. Nausea bubbles in me. Do you believe this? Suze says. I'm no expert, but who am I to say otherwise? He says. My opponents can't attack facts, so they attack success. That's what losers do, Suze. Attack winners. They say you lack empathy for children. As a father, I pray for the children. No one prays harder for them than I do. His voice slurs, degenerates to a guttural, demonic growl. His face distorts, flesh melts from the bone to reveal the skull of a bloodless fiend beneath. It kills me, Acres says. Literally kills me to see these sad events exploited to take our guns based on emotions, not facts. His voice is normal again, appearance human. My exhaustion must have me seeing things. I'm famous for saying, save our students, arm our teachers. Someone's got to fight to see those kids don't die in vain. God has chosen me as his general in this war to save America. God again. I know God. I've studied the book. Despite my protests, I was made to attend Sunday school, receive communion, achieve confirmation. I never went back after I did, but I can still attest I do not recognize this God Acres touts. Maximilian Acres, Suze says, founder of More Guns, Less Crime, and owner of the world-famous Max Gun Shop in Jessup, Iowa. As always, it's an honor to have you speak with us. God bless you, Suze, and God bless these United States of America. Who is this man? Who are you? I say. And that is from the new novel by Eric Rickstad. It's called Lilith. We'll be featuring that tomorrow, an interview with Eric Rickstad at 10:30 on Easter morning. It's a book inspired by these school shootings, and Acres, of course, inspired by, well, you can guess who. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in, and thanks for supporting your public radio station, and thanks, as always, for listening.